This is the northern panel of the Nevada Supreme Court. Justice Sata is on my right, Justice Gibbons on my left. Our first case today, in fact, we have two cases for the same defendant, which would be Cody Thiede versus State, case number 50164. Mr. Logan.
Good morning. My name is Jim Logan, representing Cody Thiede.
Yeah, Mr. Logan, could you answer one question for me? And I couldn't find it in the record. Mr. Thiede, what was his age at the time these cases occurred? I assume they were in his...
I don't know the exact age.
Give me
early
a
20s. Early 20s.
22, had Mr. Barlow says.
Thank you, Mr. Barlow.
Okay. Thank you.
I'd like to reserve 5 minutes at the end.
Sure.
My name is Jim Logan. I represent the appellant, Cody Thiede. What happened in this, there was actually two different crimes occurred on different days. First one, what happened was, or what the record seems to reflect, was there was a bunch of kids over at somebody's house. There was like five or six kids in the living room, I think, and then the victim said that Mr. Thiede jumped on her and did all kinds of groping and things like that.
Yeah, I think the first case is the one involving SC, and the second case, I guess Justice Jerry, we're going to argue that separately on
right.
JJ.
Yeah.
Can I ask you on the SC, providing, and I'm sorry if I mix the cases up, you know, it's a lot there, you know, but the one of them was the evidence of providing alcohol to minors, you know, that there was some...
That's the first one, that's this one.
Okay.
That's this one.
Why would that require a Petrocelli hearing if it had to do with this particular party and it's part of the facts of what happened, as opposed to some totally separate event?
Okay. What it is it did happen, but it's a bad act that's unrelated to the sexual assault.
Well, didn't he provide the alcohol to allegedly?
That
I guess
to be,
you said
that
it
seems
happened.
To be, that's, that seems to be.
But yeah. It's to the people that attended this party where the sexual assault occurred.
Yeah. That's another crime. I mean, it's crime to provide alcohol to minors. And
right.
So it's a separate crime. And so it's my position that it required a Petrocelli hearing to determine, to go through all the thing, whether it's part of the race gest or not. Now, when you go to the rules that have to do with whether or not something's part of the race gest, can you describe the event without this bad act? And you can. I mean, there's nothing that requires you to describe this sexual assault without...
Well, didn't the state argue that his motivation to provide the alcohol was perhaps to take advantage of the young girl? You know, like that, get him drinking and all like that?
I didn't see that in the transcript.
Okay, I don't know. I mean,
I was thinking that might be a good argument, but I didn't see that. I don't know.
And I have another question that relates to the prior bad act, the suggestion of error as well as some of the other errors. Did you object to the admission of the sentence?
This one, there wasn't an objection. It came up, you know.
That would require us to analyze this under a harmless error.
Well,
a harmful error.
Sure.
Sorry.
Well, the problem is this: do you have to object? It is a bad act, okay? And there seems to be a controversy about that. But if the prosecutor is going to bring in a bad act, then it's incumbent upon the prosecutor. There's no need for an objection because it's incumbent upon the prosecution to have a Petrocelli hearing.
So you're suggesting that the error should just be allowed to permeate the entire trial without objection, and then we should review everything?
Not at all. When you have a bad act, what I'm saying is when you have a bad act is different. You don't have to, the defense doesn't have to object to a bad act because it's incumbent upon the prosecution when they're going to bring in a bad act to have a Petrocelli hearing. They've got to say, okay, we're going to bring in this bad act and we're going to have a Petrocelli hearing. We're going to prove that this act occurred. And then we're going to have the
judge.
They
didn't think it was a separate bad act. I think that they would argue it's res justi, and moreover, they would suggest that since there was no objection, there appeared to be no problem with their proceeding in that regard.
That's their position. My position is that it is a bad act, and it's not part of. You can describe the crime, the the sexual assault that took place, the quite violent sexual assault, according to the, I'm going to get into that a little bit later, but a quite violent sexual assault that occurred upstairs at a different, you know, during the party. And so it's my position that they didn't need to, you know, there should have been a Petrocelli hearing about it. The judge, what one of my arguments about the judge, you know, what happened with the judge is that the judge, during a recess, said, oh, wait a minute, this thing came in, and I want to talk about it. And then he made an analysis and said, yes, this occurred. And then he decided that it was relevant. The judge decided it was relevant. He didn't do that. He didn't exactly say why. One of my arguments is that he didn't weigh the prejudice, the probative value of the prejudicial effects, which he should have done, which that's one of the requirements of a Petrocelli hearing. And so that wasn't done. And so that you know, was part of the problem. And since we're talking about bad acts, I might as well go into the other one.
Well, let me ask you something about, because we have res justi, it's very confusing. Because let's say that the testimony was that Mr. Titi pushed the alleged victim down, pushed her down, which would be a battery, unlawful touching.
Right.
We certainly wouldn't need a Petrocelli hearing for that, because it would be part of, you can't tell the story without telling that she was pushed down by the alleged perpetrator. So why is it so different about, well, first he supplied me alcohol to get me drunk, and then he had sex with me?
Well, did he supply the alcohol? I mean, what he did, he didn't get her drunk, and I don't know that she was drunk, actually. I mean, the alcohol was supplied to the entire party.
Well, I think that's your saving grace, is the word. It wasn't alcohol to a minor, it was alcohol to minors. And there are other people who are not victims of the alleged sexual assault, so you have may have grounds for your Petrocelli argument. But I'll hear what Mr. Barlow has to say on that issue. Okay. If you could comment on that, Mr. Barlow.
Okay. As long as we're talking about the bad acts, you know, there was another one where there was an objection, and that's when the investigating officer talked about victims, and then the judge said, well, and then there's an objection, and they say, well, strike it from the record, stuff like that. You know, can something like that be stricken from the record? I mean, basically what I was, you know, he's being portrayed, and I'm saying this bad act shouldn't have come in, this supplying alcohol shouldn't have come in, so he's being portrayed as one who supplies alcohol to minors who is guilty of several of sexual assaults, you know, several more sexual assaults, or some kind of crime. You know, whether that was a reference to this other case we're going to be doing later on, or other things, I don't know. You know, but you know, she did say there's other victims. So to me, that really hurt the, you know.
Mr. Logan, I know we got a lot of issues in this case, and if you don't mind, I know you have a presentation, but can I ask you about a couple of them that particularly concerned me?
And then
Justice Jerry will give you some more time.
That's fine. If you want to.
On this, the suitor testimony and the hearsay statement, and I think that was the verification by the doctor Souter was subject to cross-examination, and the doctor, isn't it kind of a form, he just signs off on it versus substantive testimony and all?
But yeah, it's a form he signs off on, but you know, she was not a doctor. You know, you have this person with more credentials, I guess,
right,
who's signing off on things, and that's, you know, I saw that as kind of a problem, kind of like vouching, you know, like, well, here's this lady here that's got credentials and she's qualified to testify.
Didn't she testify live? She was subject to cross-examination.
Right. Right.
You had an opportunity to review her credentials with respect to the experts.
Right. Sure.
And okay. So you think it's like vouching then?
It's like vouching. Yeah, okay. It's kind of like a vouching.
I'll move on to the next one.
Great.
Here. The one I think we're most interested in was the your argument that the state commented upon Mr. TD's failure to testify, and the comments during the closing argument that he didn't participate or whatever. Tell us what the state said that you feel was prejudicial versus Mr. TD's demeanor in the courtroom or his lack of interest in what happened or whatever.
Well, you know, there's a lot of my misconduct. There's several things that were said that were unrelated to, you know, one big issue is you can't comment on a person when they don't testify.
We all know that, so what happened?
And so when he said, and, you know, I don't want to... And to see the defendant sitting there with his head in his hands, not looking at anybody, not participating in this is significant. And so he says he's not participating, you know, is significant.
You're analogizing that by not, he didn't testify.
Yeah, right. Yes, okay. Yes.
Standard jury instruction given with respect to that the jury should not consider whether or not the defendant testified?
I'm assuming there was, but I don't.
Well, it's a standard instruction.
Standard instruction.
I guess we know that instruction's given. I'm sure Mr. Barr will argue it's harmless.
Well, it's only given, though, Justice Gibbons, if, in fact, the defendant wants it to be given. It's up to the defendant as to whether it's given or not, not the state.
I stand corrected. That's true.
I couldn't tell you. I see it so many times, I just assume it is, but I couldn't tell you that it was. But still, you still can't comment. I mean, still, it's a big comment. There's just an instruction. You know, and I understand about this. When a judge is sitting there reading instructions, I'm a lawyer, and I know what the law is. And you sit there and listen to what a judge reading all these instructions. And you get lost if you're trying to just sit in a courtroom, whether during a civil trial, when I'm not, it's like Greek, you know? So when you're talking, there's instructions, yes, there's instructions and things like this, but is a comment like this harmful? I'm beginning to run out of time, but I was a little concerned too with, you know, when you get into the facts of this case, you got some problems with the whole, you know, there was non-specific finding of sexual assault, and then we went through the three, you know, the different testimony about that, but nevertheless, that is a fact. Another issue that came in was the investigator was testifying about what this little girl said, and that's all hearsay. Now, I know it wasn't objected to, but it's bolstering. She objected to the investigation. I mean, she talked about the investigation, and that's, you know, the little girl said this, and she said this to me, and this happened to her, and that happened to her.
Well, if it's not objected to, is it?
It's not, it's plain error, but it's both. There's cases about that says it's bolstering. The grandmother and the sister both said, "Oh, my sister was sexually assaulted." Well, where did they get that information? They got it from the sister. There's only one person that's saying that this happened, and that's the victim. And that's the problem that permeates this whole case. Is there's a lot of evidence that's coming in that shouldn't be there. And the judge had a mess on his hands because there was a lot of this stuff happening. Yeah, there wasn't objections, but there was a lot of evidence that was coming in that really shouldn't have been there, and it infected the trial. And I see I have like 2.5 minutes. I better sit down if I want to be able to talk later. Thank you.
I'm going to give you an extra 2 minutes if you want to use some more time up, and I'm going to give Mr. Barlow 17 minutes. So,
if anybody has any questions, I'll just respond to him. But if you have if there's any more questions, I'd be glad to.
Mr. Barlow, I'm going to give you 17 minutes, and in your rebuttal, Mr. Logan, you'll have like 4 minutes and a few seconds left. So you can cover all the issues, Mr. Barlow, in the 17 minutes. You've got extra minutes. Thank you.
Before you proceed, Mr. Barlow, I think it is unnecessary, but nonetheless, I think that it is proper for the record for me to disclose. And I'm sorry, because I do realize this is a delayed disclosure. I had the pleasure of working with Mr. Barlow, although it was, I hate to say, 15 or 16 years ago. Nonetheless, it would certainly not influence my ability to hear this case, and I presume that there is no objection to me continuing to sit. We worked together for a very short period of time.
Mr. Logan, okay.
No.
And I apologize, Chief.
No problem.
Ms. Justice Sata, don't age us quite so bad. It's about 12 years.
Thank you.
So, please.
This means you two are a little older, that's all.
Don't add on. I'm Gregory Barlow, District Attorney for Lincoln County. I have with me today Mr. Daniel Hoagie, my deputy. You have before you the entire office of the District Attorney of Lincoln County. We bring you greetings from the eastern provinces adjacent to the state of Utah. Some interesting points. I left my pad.
And you did say that Mr. Teedy was 22 years old, Mr. Barlow?
22, 23, Mr. Teedy. And it was not part of the record. No, I'll leave that alone. Some interesting points made by Mr. Logan. And I think that the point has been made by the court that throughout this trial as to these evidentiary matters, there were no objections, either post or during the presentation of evidence. I am very well mindful of the burden that the prosecutor has to see that a fair and just trial is conducted. And that has always been my aim. But I do know that I, as a prosecutor, am not responsible for the strategy and operation of the defense. I think that's where we come in here. They talk about the alcohol matter and the minors. I submit to the court that this is part and parcel of the race just for this crime. It was a means by which Mr. Titi was able to inveigle himself into these juveniles. It was part of the story of that night and that night at the party. It set the stage for what was going to happen later, apparently. We presented no evidence and had no evidence that he intentionally or deliberately liquored up the victim to have his ways. And that was not part of the trial. Addressing briefly the testimony of Mayor Bacalli, who was not only an officer for the Sheriff's Department, was also qualified by the court as an expert due to her training and expertise in these areas. This goes specifically to the question of victims, the testimony that was elicited. As the court reviews the transcript, my questions did not ask for that type of response. They were seeking a names of individuals, the purpose of which was to provide to the jury, for the juries are always curious, that this officer had fully investigated and followed up leads to other people in investigating and drawing their conclusions. It was not there, and the court handled it very quickly, very well, and very decisively at the moment, and there was never any further argument or allusion to other victims by myself or by the defense, as far as I'm aware, in the record of this case. This was one of those times when witnesses, and knowing the background of the entire court, witnesses sometimes say things that you don't think they're going to say, or you're not expecting. They just, out it comes. And this was one of those circumstances. And certainly does not bear the import or the impact to set aside the verdict in this matter. Mr. Logan brought up the testimony of Mrs. Souter, who was the nurse practitioner, qualified sexual assault examiner with the Saints unit in Las Vegas, where our county sends all of our examinations. She was duly qualified. Her curriculum, her CV, and her qualifications were provided to the defense well in advance of trial, not just the 21 days, but well in advance of that. Certainly they could have had questions. If they had questions, they could have investigated it. They should have qualified her for challenge if that was their desire, but that they did not do. She was duly admitted by the court as an expert and gave her testimony as such. The signature of the supervising doctor, I think, was correctly realized by Justice Gibbons as it's kind of just an overseer perfunctory due and was not substantive in terms of the examination. The argument by the defense that comment on the defendant's demeanor at trial was improper or was makes it subject to a reversal, I think is very, very incorrect. The public stage of the courtroom is exactly that. We charge our juries to look, to observe, to listen, to see what's there. And that's exactly what it was. Now, I was the trial attorney with this, with my deputy. Had the defendant been able to, he would have crawled under that table. For the most part, he hid himself behind defense counsel. And I would give you, in our courtroom, so I might point out to you, if Justice Cherry is our district judge, our jury is to my left, to your right. The prosecution table comes from the jury box to the middle of the room. The well of our court is about 8 feet deep. and the defense table is to my right, typically with the attorney sitting next, closest to my table, and the defendant on the end, where he can be monitored if necessary. My observations during the course of the trial was that the defendant was hiding. I mean, he was over there. He did not look up. He did not engage anybody. To my notice, he was not particularly involved in assisting counsel in any manner. Now, this is fair. This is fair comment.
But couldn't we infer from that comment you were alluding to the fact that he could have testified and he didn't?
I would say no, Justice Gibbons, because the term I used was participation.
It sounds like he testifying,
well,
perhaps.
You know. You can participate, you can help, you can engage, you can be concerned and not testifying. I was tried to be very careful and not engage that type of comment. That would be not proper, and I would agree if I had done. It would be cause to be concerned.
Mm-hmm.
But the choice of words, participation, was not meant, nor did I do I think that it infers testimony. Now, the last argument that I heard, the question of the testimony of Officer Cowley and her use of the statements of the victim to her as a bolstering argument. One, our statute, 50.035, makes it clear that this testimony could come in. One, the victim was available, the declarant, the victim was available at trial and did testify. Two, the defense strategy in this case was to deny and to allege fabrication and lying, which the defense counsel did in cross-examination of the victim on the stand, and attempting to draw her in and to make her admit that she had fabricated. Now, with that in hand, the statute indicates that if you have the declarant available, if they testify, then these prior consistent statements may come in where there is a what they call a recent fabrication, or the second one really doesn't apply, or motive. There's that three parts, the last part of that statute. The defense themselves brought this in. They questioned her motive. They questioned her story. They accused her of lying and fabricating.
Yeah, the defense did not object to the vouching part.
And then they did not object at the time that this came in. I think the issue dies with that. Oh, one other thing on the, if I might step back to the allegations of my conduct on his participating in the trial. I think in our brief, the U.S. Supreme Court case of Doyle really does answer that question. That demeanor at trial is never interpreted as a witness situation. And I'm quoting from my brief and from that decision. Jurors should look at a defendant's demeanor. They are both truth seekers and fact finders. And that includes demeanor. In all, I believe that Mr. TD had a very fair, very complete trial. And in fact, some of the testimony of Officer Cowley could very well have been interpreted as contrary to the state's case. Simply that at first she was hesitant, didn't want to talk, didn't want to admit to things. And we did not leave that out. We brought that in efforts to be a very complete and full trial. I would submit to you that the assertions made by the defense here in this case, or the appellant, do not rise to a level, especially when there was no objection made at trial. There's no plain error and no reason for the court to set aside this decision. Thank you.
Mr. Logan. You have 4 minutes and 5 seconds.
Great. Thank you. First thing I'd say is that I'm not questioning the prosecutor's integrity or anything. He said what he said, and maybe he didn't mean what he says. I'll take
that what he says, but what he said can be interpreted as commenting on the guy not testifying.
Mr. Logan, did you have a chance that, well, Mr. Barlow was arguing to see if you requested the jury instruction about
no,
defendant?
No, I didn't.
Maybe you could do that before we finish the argument. Was that given or not about the jury instruction about, I don't want to interrupt you right now, but we'd like to know that.
I have the appendix, but I don't know if it's in there.
Well, why don't you go ahead and maybe the state can help us out on
that. Sure. The other thing, he's talking about plain error, and, you know, plain error means that it's an error, that there's some kind of, you know, it's that there's some kind of case law on it. It's pretty clear that this is, you can't be doing this kind of stuff. And, you know, when you talk about what I allege is misconduct during the closing argument, it's in my brief. I'm sure it's in your bench memo. He talks about joining, you know, he talks about where the people, we got to protect children and all this other business. So he's asking the jury, you know, he's telling them that they got to protect, you know, they got this duty. Their duty is to decide whether or not this guy's guilty or not. Not to protect the community, not to protect children, and saying something like
that. Mr. Just, you know, we have all your briefs, and so we don't rely on just bench memos. We have the briefs right here.
I've heard their bench memos are pretty good. Okay. Never having. But, you know, with that in mind, I think a lot of these things, I realize there weren't objections, you know, but a lot of these things are pretty clear.
You realize, of course, the dilemma that places us in, and that is the standard of review. Without objection, it has to be plain error. We have to see that it affected the constitutional rights of the defendant in this case. It's a high standard.
I understand it's a high standard. But these are big errors too. You've got, it's my position that her testimony was vouching. You had another vouching incident where she's talking, where the Ms. Cowley is talking about. You know, they had problems with discrepancies in the little girl's testimony. There was problems with whether or not there was a lock on the door. There was problems this wasn't a loud and boisterous party, yet she described being violently. She describes yelling. Nobody heard it. She describes being thrown around the room. There's all these things. So they had some problems. So the investigator talked about, you know, how a victim sometimes puts things in or leaves things out or whatever, and that she exhibited signs of being victimized, and therefore that explained the thing. So that, to me, is vouching for her credibility. They also talked about Thede and, you know, how he talked about somebody else assaulting her, and how then she says, well, criminals do that, you know, they put themselves in a third party and start talking about this. So she's saying that he's lying, you know. She's not saying it in so many words, but you can't be vouching for people. A lot of her testimony was irrelevant. What's relevant in this?
Doesn't her expert qualifications speak to, allow her to speak to precisely the tendencies of both victims and those who are accused?
I don't think so. Can cops?
Finish your thought.
Cops, police officers like to say that they know when somebody's lying or not, and they can't tell any better than anybody else. That's been scientifically Sheldon and psychologists say that. But they like to think so, but they can't. And that's why we can't have police and things talk about who. It's up to the jury. Thank you very much.
Thank you. This case will stand submitted. And take a deep breath, and we'll go on to the next TV.